Okay, well, thank you, Ken. And one comment before I start is, with the comments we've had about cults, I think it's very refreshing in a commentary on ACD's spiritual state where we're at that we can have a joint presentation on different and divergent views on the same subject. We remain friends. Doesn't matter whether we agree or disagree, even after that. We still stay brethren. Did I say that with a bit of hopefulness? Yes. Yes. Well, my portion is entitled, The Earth is Indefinitely Old. And before I comment on that, what is at stake in this issue? And the answer to this question is, the Earth young and old? It's not a pass-fail Christian litmus test at all. However you feel about it, we can still remain friends. Now, when humans disagree on something in a courtroom or wherever, one of the best pieces of evidence that can be mustered is the testimony of a reliable eyewitness. In the Old Testament, God required eyewitnesses before anyone could be convicted of a capital offense. In the New Testament, the apostles stressed they were eyewitnesses of the resurrection, appealing to that Old Testament standard of strong evidence. Now, on the Earth's prehistory, we obviously don't have a human eyewitness. However, we do have one eyewitness regarding Earth's prehistory, and he's infallible. I'm referring to God, who has certain eyewitness accounts in the Bible about Earth's prehistory, which I'll rely on today. For Christians who believe the Bible is God's inspired word, the Bible must be the final arbiter in this matter. And I'd like to repeat that line. The Bible must be the final arbiter in this matter. Human logic and physical evidence can be mustered to support either side of this issue, but human reasoning must always yield to the word of God. In this presentation, I'll offer both scriptural and physical evidence demonstrating the earth is indefinitely old, in my opinion. Most of my evidence will be scriptural because this is a Christian audience that believes the Bible is the word of God. If this were an audience of agnostic paleontologists, I would include much more physical evidence and less scripture. But first, let's consider how God relates to time. Psalm 90, verse 2 states, "Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hadst formed the earth, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God." So God exists eternally in either direction from the present. Now, with no beginning, God is older than we can possibly define time. Millions or billions of years, if the earth is that old, in human time are still less than the age of God. So the question is this: how long has God, a timeless and a creating being, been working with matter on earth in a creative way? As a timeless creating being, has he only worked with matter for, say, the last 6,000 years? If so, that's a mere eye blink in the life of God. Now, God is billions of years old plus. Has he worked for only 6,000 years, or has he been working out his plan in a patient way on this earth over a period of ages or eons? Now, let's consider the gap theory. It's generally called a theory by those who disagree with it, but I will offer biblical. Those of you who know me and have heard me before know I tend to be sometimes dogmatic. Now, but I will offer biblical evidence that shows the gap theory is, in my opinion, not a theory, but clear biblical teaching, and then merge it into a larger biblical context which further supports it. We'll begin in Genesis 1:1, which states, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth." How did he initially create it? Isaiah 45, verse 18, I believe, supplies the answers. I'll read this first in the King James. "Thus saith the Lord that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it. He hath established it. He created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord." Now I'll read this in the New Jerusalem Bible. "Thus says Yahweh, the creator of the heavens. He is God who shaped the earth and made it, who set it firm. He did not create it to be chaos. He formed it to be lived in. I am Yahweh." Now here is one of God's eyewitness accounts. When God created the earth, he tells us that he created it not in vain or in chaos. And the Hebrew word translated in vain or in chaos is tohu, T-O-H-U. When God created the earth, he said it was not tohu and that he made it to be lived in or to be inhabited. Now in Genesis 1:2, still before creation week, it states, "And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters." The Hebrew word for void in that passage is tohu. So although in Isaiah 45:18, God himself tells us that he did not create the earth tohu, by Genesis 1:2, the earth is definitely tohu. So what happened? Well, before we answer that question, let's also consider Job 38, verses 4 to 7. I'm just reading excerpts. "Where were you," God says to Job, "when I laid the foundations of the earth? Who hath laid the measures, or who has stretched a line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened, or who laid the cornerstone thereof? When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. When the earth was first created, the angels shouted for joy at what a beautiful earth God had made. In words like foundations, measuring, stretching a line, fastened, cornerstone, show that God was engineering an orderly, formed, beautiful earth. It wasn't just a formless blob or void that God set in the ether. So Job 38 supports Isaiah 45 that God initially made the earth habitable and orderly, or not tohu. So God, our eyewitness, tells us that the earth was created in that manner when he first made it. So how did it become tohu in Genesis 1:2? Well, in Ezekiel 28, verses 12 to 15, these are excerpts from the New Jerusalem Bible, God describing Lucifer. The Lord Yahweh says this, "You used to be a model of perfection, full of wisdom, perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. On the day you were created, I made you a living creature with outstretched wings as guardian. Your behavior was exemplary from the day you were created until guilt first appeared in you. I have thrown you down from the mountain of God, guardian, winged creature." A second passage in Isaiah 14, verses 12 to 14, and I'll read this excerpt from the King James. "How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God, and I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High." Lucifer, when he ascended, went above the clouds. And clouds exist in an earth's atmosphere where water vapor is possible, not in the ether of space. His rebellion led him to being cut down, the Bible says, to the ground. That word is translated from the Hebrew word eretz, which is translated earth over 600 times in the Bible. That same word, eretz, is used in Genesis 1 and Isaiah 45 to describe the earth which God initially created to be inhabited and not in chaos. So I have a conclusion that Lucifer, for an indefinite time, lived as a perfect being on a lovely inhabited eretz, but he later rebelled. He ascended above the earth's clouds, was hurled back to the ground, this eretz, by God. So Lucifer apparently ruled this earth. He was called a guardian or a covering cherub. Lucifer's position as earth's ruler is consistent with Christ having to be tempted by him to replace him. And Paul called him, when he was called Satan, called him the prince of this world and the ruler of this darkness till Christ returns. Now consider Jude 6 and 13, which states, "The angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness. Raging waves of the sea, foaming out their own shame, wandering stars, to whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever." So the angels' first estate that they left had to be earth, the place of atmospheric clouds that they ascended above to attack God, and the eretz to which they were hurled back. Jude, when he said they left their habitation, I believe was referring to the earth. Remember, God said he initially made the earth to be inhabited. Now, angels, of course, don't need clouds, water, vapor, or an atmosphere to live as spirit beings, but physical creatures do. And I think there were physical creatures on this earth at that time. We'll have more on that later, and also in the movie Jurassic Park. So, which is the supplemental to my message today. Now, Jude's imagery that the fallen angels were in darkness and like foaming waves of the sea coincides with the state of the earth after their rebellion that's described, I feel, in Genesis 1:2, when the earth was a place of darkness with waters covering the planet. Now, remember that Isaiah 14 said Lucifer, after he rebelled, was cut down to the ground, or the eretz. The eretz, or earth, was already here for Satan and his angels to be cast down to prior to creation week. So the earth had to be here for an indefinite period of time before mankind ever came on the scene. Since Lucifer's first estate was earth, and after his revolt he was cast back down to the earth, well, what happened to the material universe during this war or rebellion among spirit beings? Well, whereas Isaiah 45 told us the earth was initially to be inhabited and orderly, Genesis 1:2 shows us the earth somewhere before creation week became a dark, flooded mess. I think clearly no land life forms in which was the breath of life could have survived this divine warfare that left the earth a flood. There is a possibility some aquatic life, like the coelacanth or possible plesiosaurs, could have survived in a deep water. That's speculative. But consider that when God gave the rainbow as a sign, quote, "that the waters shall no more become a flood to destroy all flesh," it implies that worldwide floods have occurred more than once as God's means of destroying, quote, all flesh on earth. Genesis 1:2 confirms that at least one other worldwide destructive flood occurred other than Noah's flood. So God's promise to me argues that there was fleshly life on earth prior to that initial flood as well, as in the angelic world which became flooded. Now let's look at creation week. God does not tell us how long the earth remained in this flooded, darkened state of Genesis 1:2. Was it weeks? Was it millions of years? We simply don't know. The key fact, though, is that the earth was here for an indefinite period of time prior to creation week transforming the earth's surface. In Genesis 1, verses 3 to 4, on the first day, God said, "Let there be light." And he did this by dividing the light from the darkness. In Genesis 1, verses 6 to 8, on the second day, God divided floodwaters on the earth into a layer above and one below the earth's firmament or atmosphere. God didn't need to create any water yet on the earth. He was simply dividing the water that was already here on a pre-existent earth. So in the first 2 days, God isn't creating everything here by fiat. He is basically cleaning up the mess that the earth had become to prepare it for creation week. He's working with physical materials, in other words, on an already existing earth that's already indefinitely old before creation week starts. Now, in the rest of creation week, God is creating things by fiat. But notice one intriguing thing that initially is hard to explain. In verses 14 to 19, on the fourth day, it says, God made two great lights to rule the day and the night, obviously the sun and the moon. Now, this argues that our current sun up there in the sky above us was not made till the fourth day of creation week. Did a previous sun, Nova, in the heavenly war, that would explain the need for a new sun. However, consider a possible alternative. When God divided the darkness from the light on day one, there was light coming from somewhere already, even though God says he didn't make the sun till the fourth day. So the light that existed in verses 4 to 13 was not coming from our physical sun. But there were days and nights on the earth. It says the evening and the morning were the first day, and the second day, and the third day. Well, where do we come to grips with this mystery? Consider Revelation 21, verses 1 and 23. This is after the millennium is over in prophecy. Verse 1 describes the creation of a new heaven and a new earth, because the first heaven and first earth will pass away. Verse 23 states, "And the city," this means New Jerusalem at that time, "had no need of the sun, neither of the moon, to shine in it, for the glory of God did lighten it, and the Lamb is the light thereof." Now Acts 3:21 foretells of a time of the restitution of all things. Revelation 21 gives us a glimpse of that time when all things are restored to a sinless state. And it tells us the earth won't need any physical sun for radiance, but God's radiance will provide the light. Could it be that in the sinless world before Lucifer rebelled, there was no sun in our solar system, that God's own radiance provided the light on earth, just like God says he will do after the millennium? In Revelation 22:13, Jesus Christ says, "I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end." Revelation 21 tells us that in the end, the Father and Christ will provide the earth's radiance, and perhaps it was that way in the beginning. Now, in the beginning of my presentation, I promised to relate the gap theory to a larger biblical context, and I'll try to do that now. Let's establish that God accomplishes his purposes on earth through a series of ages, or periods of time in which God has various dispensations and purposes. Ages, when mentioned in the Bible, are based generally on the Greek word aeon, from which we get the English word eon. I'll just write that for... And your Webster's dictionary will show that the English word eon directly comes from this word as its etymological root. Now, Webster defines this word eon, which comes from this Greek word, as an extremely long, indefinite period of time. Also, the word, I checked this with Charles to make sure I wasn't giving any Greek heresies on this, because I'm not a Greek scholar. But anyway, the adjective form of that word, aeon, is the word in the Bible which is frequently translated everlasting or eternal, which gives you an idea how extremely long an aeon could be. Now, in Ephesians 2:7, Paul wrote that in the ages to come, he, God, might show the exceeding riches of his grace and his kindness toward us through Christ Jesus. In Colossians 1:26, Paul added, "Even the mystery which hath been hid from ages, but now is made manifest to his saints." Paul says in these two scriptures that there will be ages, plural, into the future, and that there have been ages, plural, in the past from which God hid certain mysteries. Now, the Greek word aeon is frequently translated world in English Bibles, and some passages take on a little bit different connotation when translated age or aeon. 2 Corinthians 4:4, for example, in whom the God of this age or aeon hath blinded the minds of which believe not. Or Ephesians 1:21, which states, it's Paul speaking of Christ being set above all principalities and powers, not only in this age or aeon, but also in that which is to come. So the Bible asserts that there have been past and future eons or ages in God's plan. But our quick key question is, in how many of those ages has the earth been here? So let's discuss the ages as best we can discern them from the Bible, and you can see if you agree with my analysis or not. Okay, let's try this ink to see if it works better. This would be age one. God plus what? Since we know that even Lucifer and his angels are created beings, there had to be an age in which God existed but not the angels. About this age, we virtually know nothing. That's God's secret. But I believe we can agree there was no physical earth yet at that point, as we'll see. How long this lasted, or if in fact time even existed in a human sense, we don't know when God started working with matter. Age two. I'm running out of space here. God plus angels. The earth, which is not tohu, and I believe flesh, which I consider to be the dinosaur realm. Now, this would be the age in which God made angels, but before Lucifer's sin, where the angels were still sinless. This still predates mankind, as Creation Week account says nothing about angels being created in that seven-day period, and Satan was already here as a sinful angel in the Garden of Eden, so he clearly predates that. In this age, God made the angels and earth. In Ezekiel 28, verse 13, it mentions Lucifer is described as being perfect in his ways from the day in which he was created, so he had his beginning here. Job 38, verse 4 to 7 states the angels were there when God made the earth. Remember that in Isaiah 45, 18, God told us he made it not tohu, and he made it to be inhabited. I think we can make the case that the angels, this was their first estate, but we know he made it with clouds, with water vapor, with a ground to which Satan could be cast down to, and all of those physical things are requirements for a physical fleshly life. Now, it's interesting that Lucifer is called a serpent or a dragon after he fell, that he was the earth's ruler, and the fossil record confirms that earth was once inhabited by a great deal of serpents and dragons, if we can call the dinosaurs that. Did that prehistoric world have beasts that were generally made in Lucifer's likeness and image? We don't know how long this age or eon went on, or how long Lucifer ruled perfectly before he sinned. It could be millions of years, millennia, we don't know. But this second age closed when iniquity was found in Lucifer. Now, I don't think an alarm clock went off in his head and he said, this is it, this is the day I have to rebel. I don't think perfection can rot in a day. And I think even the fossil record, I think, tends to support a gradual change in Lucifer's nature, the world over which he was ruling. Paleontologists divide the dinosaur era into several periods of time, the Triassic, the Jurassic, and the Cretaceous. The earliest dinosaur fossil period, the Triassic, is dominated by herbivores. The middle period, the Jurassic, had herbivores and smaller predators. In the Encyclopedia Americana, I use a simple one, so if anyone wants to check my source, you can, states a larger predator, the Allosaurus, first appeared in the strata in the late Jurassic. In the final, or for us that's the most recent period, the Cretaceous, we see the emergence of huge dinosaurs equipped for fighting on a grand scale. According to the Americana, and that is a recent edition of it, the Ankylosaurs were a heavily armored group of dinosaurs that lived during the Cretaceous. The horned dinosaurs, or the Triceratopsians, also appeared in the Cretaceous. The massive Tyrannosaurus rex represents the end of the line. It and its relatives did not appear until the late Cretaceous, appear as if they just came out of nothing. Its brief existence, along with that of all other dinosaurs, was terminated at the end of that period. Now, when you see the movie Jurassic Park, realize that not all those dinosaurs were contemporary with one another, according to what we see in that fossil record. And while I'm certainly a creationist and I reject the theory of evolution out of hand, as I'm sure Jim does, scientists are not fools. There's a lot of people that, even though they do not have God in their knowledge, they are trying, honestly, to try to come up with theories about what happened in the strata that we can examine. So how do we put all this in a biblical context? Well, God said he created the world to be inhabited. Acts 3:21 tells us there will be a restitution of all things when Christ returns. And Romans 8:22 says the whole creation groans and travails in pain, waiting for the manifestation of the sons of God. And in Isaiah 11, we have the famous scripture about when Christ is here, the lion will lay down with the lamb, and the lion will eat straw like an ox. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain. So when God rules the earth, there will be no predatory flesh-eating animals at all. So how do we reconcile that with a dinosaur world when there clearly were predator and prey animals? Did God first make a violent earth where the dinosaurs killed and chewed each other? I don't think so, because when God rules the earth, and he's the same yesterday, today, and forever, he's going to end predatory natures in animals. And Lucifer, when he was a perfect being, undoubtedly first ruled God's way, which was peaceable. But I believe we see in the progression of dinosaurs a gradual testimony to Lucifer's degeneration. It goes from peaceful herbivores, bringing in smaller predators. Then in the Cretaceous, you have large armored herbivores and predators who could fight each other, followed by the dinosaurs' extinction. Now, I want to give you something to think about. It's speculative material, and I want to label that at this point. It's not ACD doctrine, and it's not my doctrine, but I want to give you some options because I don't see any but these two. If you think it's even a heretical option, please hold your stones until after I can explain it. But the Bible doesn't tell us how much power God delegated to Lucifer during this period of time. But either God created this progression of different dinosaurs, they didn't spring by spontaneous generation out of the ground then either, or are you ready for this? Lucifer had a role in it. Now wait a minute, you might say. God wouldn't allow Lucifer to either gradually go bad or he wouldn't allow him to create anything. Oh? God gave the Old Testament rulers of Israel and Judah a lot of time to degenerate before he stepped in and punished them. God says, I do not change in Malachi. It's likely God gave Lucifer a lot of slack time as well. Would you say, well, God certainly wouldn't share the power to create? Are you sure? Can you prove that to me in the Bible? Is there a scripture that says we are the first beings who will ever be the ones that God, with whom God will share that power? He's creating mankind to become heirs of all things. The Bible doesn't specifically say we're going to be the first to have any delegation of that power. Perhaps God first shared that power with the most exalted angel of all and learned that no angel could handle that power without the indwelling of God's own Holy Spirit. And the plan for mankind, a being made in God's own image, had to be implemented. Now, before you assume that God wouldn't delegate limited creative power, remember that mankind is right now a little lower than the angels, and we're sinful. And yet God has already delegated to us, being sinful, a role in the power to create. Think of that the next time you look at your children, or I look at mine. Since God has already given creative power and shared it with sinful mankind, maybe we shouldn't be so quick to assume that God didn't share that same power with an exalted angel who was then perfect. But whether Lucifer had a limited role within God's parameters to create or choose certain physical life forms he wanted on earth, or whether God did it, and that even raises questions also, but we don't have time to go into it. There is a witness, I feel, in the fossil record of that progression. If God was sharing creative powers with Lucifer, it makes it more understandable for me to see how on earth Lucifer could think he could rebel against God. If that was the case, he could say, well, God creates, and I create. I'm as good as God. That kind of a mentality could develop. And that also could explain why one-third of the angels, if they were the ones under him, would even follow him against God, because if they saw Lucifer as that exalted, maybe they thought he was as good as God. And remember, in the Bible, we don't see God waxing eloquent about Gabriel or Michael or whatever, but we do see that about Lucifer. Makes you wonder, did God even plan that outcome? In Isaiah 45:7, where God talks about the earth's prehistory, he says, I make peace and I create evil. But back to what we know for sure. After God hurled Lucifer back to the earth, Lucifer and his angels wandered like waves of the sea on a dark and flooded planet. Then we come to the third age that I think we can identify in the Bible. That's God plus angels. And some of these are now sinful. Earth is still here. But now it is tohu, where it wasn't when God first made it. How long was this age? Well, again, we don't know. It could have been lengthy. The organic material of the dinosaur era could have had millions of years to compress into coal and oil. If so, God was just prepositioning matter for mankind. But one thing we must realize is that time, as experienced by spirit beings, is so much different than for us. If that one day of spirit time equals 1,000 years of our time standard that God gives us in Psalm 90 and 2 Peter 3 is valid for comparing, a one-year prison sentence for a spirit being would equal 365,000 of our years. A three-year prison sentence for Lucifer, who became Satan, would be 1,000,000 earth years. How bad was Satan's sin? Leading the first rebellion against God himself, would he be worthy of more than a one-year or three-year prison sentence? Again, I'm using that time comparison. We don't know how long this age lasted, but again, we know the earth was here for as long as it lasted. And then the last age that we can, I think, identify is our modern one, where we have God. To save time, I won't write angels. Some are sinful, some are not. We have the earth, but it's restored. It's no longer tohu, and we also have mankind in the modern age created. Now, how many ages or eons occurred then before we ever get to creation week? We don't know how old it is, our earth is, in terms of physical years, but the Bible, the record of God, our infallible eyewitness, tells us the earth has been here through all or parts of three of those ages, or eons. And Paul chose to use that Greek word aeon in signifying a long and definite period of time when he wrote about these ages. So the earth was here as long as Lucifer was here ruling that first estate before he rebelled. The earth was also here during the time it was tohu, or in flooded, desolate state. Now, if the earth is millions of years old in terms of human years, it is compatible with a literal understanding of the Bible. Even if Carl Sagan is right that there's billions and billions of years, it's still compatible with a literal understanding of the Bible. Christians don't need to prove the earth is, quote, only 6,000 years old in order to defend the Bible. It isn't necessary. The Bible allows for a very old earth. Now, a comment on radiocarbon dating. I believe it is accurate only as far back as Noah's flood. God clearly altered mankind's lifespans in that pre-flood era and the post-flood era from maybe a 1,000-year lifespan to a 70-year lifespan. So matter has clearly aged at a different rate in the post-flood world. Radiocarbon dating, which assumes that there is a steady rate of constant decay, cannot be accurate when matter has decayed at different rates in two different periods. Now, when did the mastodons, mammoths, and saber-toothed tigers live? I think that has an easy answer. God created many species of animals in creation week, and they had approximately 16 centuries to diversify into subspecies of their genus kinds before the flood came. When Noah built the ark, he lived in one finite area of the earth. And Genesis 7 tells us that Noah had each genus kind of animal represented on the ark, but not necessarily every subspecies all over the earth. So we have lions and tigers, but not saber-toothed tigers. We have elephants, but not mastodons and mammoths. Now, many subspecies of the mammals died out in the flood, even though the genus kinds were preserved. And the suddenness of the mammals die-off is attested by the finding of mammoths quick frozen in the permafrost while they were in the act of eating. Flesh was preserved on their bodies and even the food in their mouths. And of that, I am an eyewitness because I went to Minneapolis at our new mega mall to see an exhibit from the Leningrad Museum of fully assembled mammoths, rhinos, other types of mammals with the flesh on of them, some of them in perfect condition. You would think they died last week. So I know they do exist. Now, did mankind exist with the dinosaurs? My own personal opinion is no. I don't think the fossil record supports that concept. Genesis 6 in the pre-flood world says mankind multiplied on the face of the earth in that pre-flood era. If the dinosaurs were contemporary with man, there should be many human skeletons found in the same strata as dinosaurs, and there aren't any. And also, I want you to ask yourself when you see that movie Jurassic Park, how compatible do you think mankind would have been in a world where there were predators walking around taller than this hotel? I think mankind would have quickly become hors d'oeuvres, and we would have been extinct. And Genesis 1 describes God creating cattle and birds in creation week. And these are representatives of a mammal's world, not the dinosaur world. I don't see any evidence that Herefords and Tyrannosaurs existed at the same time. Now, what about Leviathan or Behemoth of Job? There are some sources, Young's Analytical Concordance or Harper's Bible Dictionary, regard Behemoth as a hippo. Harper's Bible Dictionary traces Leviathan as a term to early Ugaritic mythology with which Job was likely familiar. But whatever they were, there's no hard evidence that they were dinosaurs who had descended from these earlier fossils we find. God certainly did create reptiles in Genesis week because it says creeping things. So there could have been species of reptiles which were much larger than the ones we have now that went extinct. Now consider some physical evidence and then I'll close. One area where I will agree with the assertions of the young earth theorists, the topographical changes on the earth's surface can happen quickly, in years instead of centuries. Mount St. Helens studies have shown that topographical changes that were once assumed to take eons took only a few years. And I'm not convinced the Colorado River slowly eroded the Grand Canyon over millions of years. When you fly on a plane to this area, as many of you, like I did, came when coming here, you see the evidence of a flooded earth. There's huge drainage areas in those mountains and canyons that you can see from the sky. Genesis 1 asserts that God divided the waters in a way which let dry land appear in one day. So perhaps could the migration of those continental plates lifting up the mountain range and creating continents have taken place in one day? I suppose that's a theoretical extreme. But the key point is, demonstrating that the earth's surface can be quickly changed does not prove the earth itself is young. It demonstrates only that evolutionary gradualism is wrong. It doesn't disprove the old earth concept. The earth was already here when it was quickly changed, no matter how many times that's occurred. Demonstrating that the earth's surface can change quickly disproves the evolutionary assumptions about the rate of geological change. That's all it disproves. Now, I believe true science supports the biblical view of prehistory I've given you. Science has shown that a thin layer of iridium is found all over the earth, and this supports the concept the dinosaur world perished in a barrage of meteorites. I'll give you several quotes from a National Geographic article from June of 89 entitled Extinctions. Iridium is rare on Earth, but common in meteorites. Continuing, it is found worldwide, and the layer of iridium is right at the boundary between the Cretaceous period when there were dinosaurs and the Tertiary when there were none. Cretaceous, if you'll remember, was the last dinosaur period, and Tertiary starts to identify the age of mammals. Continuing again with the quote, this proposal that Earth was hit by asteroids has been backed up by abundant and convincing evidence from around the globe. Experts studying the clay see clear evidences of an impact. The article also adds that high amounts of soot are found in this iridium layer, indicating that great fires swept the Earth before it became flooded. But I see no evolution between the pre-Adamic flood period and the time that came after that. Some evolutionary charts show a few mammals, they call them, in the age of the dinosaurs, but this article in National Geographic hedges that and only calls them mammal-like reptiles that existed with the dinosaurs. So the current scientific view is that one huge or many meteorite hits devastated the Earth, throwing up huge clouds of particles which would have blotted out the light. This could have prevented photosynthesis and killed the dinosaurs, bringing the dark Earth that we found in Genesis 1-2. Now, if that pre-Adamic world had a water canopy like it did after God restored it, all that particulate matter would have condensed that water vapor, bringing it down on the Earth and bringing the flood, which also was there in Genesis 1-2. Now, that National Geographic article also adds that in prehistoric times, quote, seas dominated the world. Most land was submerged, unquote. So even scientists now acknowledge that the ancient Earth has undergone periods when oceans dominated it. And that sounds a lot like Genesis 1-2. I believe God chose to destroy the prehistoric Earth's life forms after Lucifer's sin, even as God destroyed life from the face of the Earth during Noah's time because of man's sin. The National Geographic article adds, scientists now know that the story of life on Earth has been punctuated by mass extinctions. They come up with more than two, by the way. The Bible reveals two mass extinctions, one in Noah's time and one between the time God originally created the earth, inhabitable, and when it became tohu. So the final conclusions I've got to leave with you is, the Bible asserts the gap theory, in my opinion, is not a theory, but a biblical doctrine attested to by a reliable eyewitness, God himself. Genesis 1:1 says there was a beginning when God created the heavens and the earth, and God himself tells us in Isaiah 45:18, thus saith Yahweh statement, that when he first made it, he made it not tohu, and it was inhabitable. Yet Genesis 1-2 shows it had become tohu before creation week. But we can know that the earth was here throughout those previous times before creation week. From what Paul tells us about God's plan involving an unknown number of future and past ages or eons, The earth has been here, in my opinion, through all or parts of several ages or eons, before creation week. Our modern age is approximately 6,000 years old, but how long the earth was here during at least two previous ages, I cannot tell you, and we cannot know. I'll close with a reminder of the dictionary definition of eon, which is derived from that Greek word aeon, which Paul knowingly chose to use to describe those previous ages. It's an extremely long, indefinite period of time. So I see an assertion in the Word of God that there have been ages or eons in the earth's past, and the earth has been here through all or parts of at least three ages. So I would submit to you that God, our reliable eyewitness, says the earth is very old, indefinitely old, and I think God's eyewitness testimony should settle the issue. And I'll leave some handouts with you that hit the high points of what I said, because I spoke rather fast, so it was probably hard to take notes. It's just a two-page handout, so. And that concludes my portion. Now Jim will try to break down everything I said.
Break, so I'll be sure to keep you a couple hours. Just a couple words before I begin. I am a Polak from Milwaukee, as some people call me. Some people call me a cheesehead, and that's fine. We're from Wisconsin. But I do not, before I begin, just to let you know, I do believe the earth is round, okay? It's not flat, okay? Okay? Now, the reason why I said that is because many people who view the earth as young are classified as those who simply, you know, just the same as those who believe that the world is flat. So I do believe the earth is round. Cosmologists and cosmogonists, they put forth theories, facts, and what have you, that the earth is 4.5 billion years old. You can consult any science textbook, and that's simply what, it'll be a fact. Earth, 4.5 billion years old. Universe, or the other various galaxies, originated somewhere between 70 and 20 billion years old, and of course matter was always eternal. That's kind of their viewpoint. It's interesting that within the past 20 years, that view has changed radically. 20, 30 years ago, the Earth was only 1.5, 2 billion years. Universe, galaxies was only about 5 to 10 billion years. And again, what I want everyone to understand is the origin of an old Earth, why many Christians today believe in old Earth. And I firmly believe it has nothing to do with the Bible right here. It's all brainwashing from secular science. I will not be able to, contrary to what many of you might expect, prove a young Earth. Steve cannot, nor did he, prove an old Earth. No pastor, no theologian, no scholar can prove an old Earth, young Earth, and for that matter, no great scientist, Carl Sagan, you name him, will never be able to prove the age of the Earth, both in an absolute sense and in an empirical scientific sense. Now let me explain. First, let's say the absolute sense. I was not there at creation. You were not there at creation. We did not witness, we did not see creation. And in a scientific empirical sense, and remember what empirically, scientifically means is what we observe today. Scientists use what they call the scientific method. Now what is the scientific method? Well, the scientific method is simply being able to reproduce facts and data in a laboratory setting in today's time, okay? So when they have, like, say, a hypothesis, an assumption, they need to test this hypothesis, this assumption, and the way they go about this is to test it in the laboratory or test it today, you know, what they can see and observe today. The science is knowledge, it's facts. However, the old Earth and young Earth, that is history, okay? That's a question of history. It's not empirical science. I was not there, you were not there. And if I may interject, we can look at evolution and creation in the same model. Evolution and creation cannot be proven scientifically, nor will ever be proven scientifically using the scientific method. And contrary to what you may have heard, evolution is not a scientific theory. It cannot be. It can never qualify as a scientific theory. For the simple fact is that a theory is something that is able to be tested and observed today. No one has ever made evolution happen in a laboratory, and no one could ever make creation happen in a laboratory. Even creation, again, cannot qualify as a scientific theory. If anything, there are non-testable assumption, non-testable hypothesis. And I want everyone to understand that, contrary to what your children, to what you have been taught, it's not a scientific theory. You want to call it a theory, a general theory, that's fine, but it is not a scientific theory. So whenever you get in a debate with someone regarding evolution science, keep that in the back of your mind that, hey, you can't prove it, I can't prove it empirically, can't use the scientific method. What do secular scientists teach us today? They say your Earth is 4.5 billion years old. So how do they go about that? How does your children, how do you, through the schooling, come with this assumption that the Earth is billions of years old? Many pastors and ministers also teach your Earth is billions of years old. Is it from the Bible? I believe it's not from the Bible. I believe it's simply taught in the education system itself. And it's all what scientists use, secular scientists use, what they would call geochronometers. Simply a big word, just an instrument or process that measures time, or in this particular case would be a process of the Earth. There are a few geophysical processes, geochronometers, if you will, that secular scientists show, give evidence, if you will, that the Earth is quite old. And before I forget, let's keep the idea of evolution, creation, young Earth, old Earth, let's treat them as models. Okay, because we can't classify them as a scientific theory, let's classify them as models. Models make predictions. So whatever model, like a young Earth, old Earth, we can make predictions what we should observe today in the 20th century. If the young Earth model is fact, we should observe these things today. If the old Earth model is fact, we should observe these things today. We make predictions by using scientific models. So let's treat the whole issue today as scientific models. Secular scientists use one particular, that they call gospel, method, and that is the radiometric system. Notice I did not say radiocarbon. Radiocarbon is done on organic, once-living materials. Obviously, all secular scientists know they're immaterial, that is, inorganic materials lived before organic materials. Therefore, as what Steve even touched on, radiocarbon dating is very inaccurate. It's only good for a few thousand years, 30, 40,000 years in a secular scientist realm also. So they use what they would call radiometric dating, and they use what they would call the uranium-lead method, potassium-argon, and rubidium-strontium. How they come out with 4.5 billion years, they do not use the fossil record, okay? They know they don't use the fossil record. They can't use the fossil record because it's all circular reasoning, and that's for a whole other subject. They use what they, again, radiometric dating. So they find these igneous rocks. And what are igneous rocks? Well, igneous rocks are rocks that are cooled from a molten state, like a lava rocks formed from volcanic eruption. So they go to these rocks and they say, there's this particular amount of uranium in there, and there's this particular amount of radiogenic lead in there. And they know that the half-life of, what I mean by half-life, is the amount of the time that it takes of a substance or force to decay in half, to lose half of that substance and force. They know that's a fact that takes 4.5 million years for half the amount of uranium to decay into lead. And also the potassium-argon is the half-life of that, that takes potassium to decay into argon is 1.25 billion years. So they go out to these particular rocks, and notice they use rocks to date the age of the Earth. Take note of that. They take these rocks, and they say, there's this much uranium here, and there's this much lead in here. Therefore, we know that it decays at this half rate. Okay, so the Earth is this old. But obviously, there's problems with that. And to give you an example to illustrate the problems of radiometric dating, remember, this is gospel to them, okay? This is it. This is the best evidence they have to prove an old Earth. Let me give you an example. Let's say you were to walk into a room. The room's abandoned. There you would see on the table a burning candle. By observation, what you see of this candle by observing it for an hour, you notice that it took 1 inch for the wax to decrease, to decay. If I'd ask you a question, how long that room has been abandoned, how long that candle has been burning, can you give me a satisfying answer? Would you be comfortable with that answer that you would give me? Or could you give me an answer? And obviously you could not give me an answer. It'd be impossible for several reasons. First of all, you would have to know the exact length or height of that candle when it was first lit. You would also have to know that, was it always constant? Was that candle always burning at a rate of 1 inch per hour? Well, the same is true with radiometric dating. In this piece of rock, was there always this much uranium? Was there lead, radiogenic lead, in the beginning? Were they there together with one another? Was the rate of decay always 4.5 billion years? Was that the half-life? Was it always consistent? And these are all presuppositions, assumptions that the scientists, they simply say yes, and it falls into what is known as uniformitarianism. Now, uniformitarianism is a geological doctrine that presumes that all processes we observe today have been going on with no changes, and that there have been some catastrophes in the local areas, if you will, but never a worldwide catastrophe. So in other words, the speed of light has always been constant. The radial decay of uranium to lead, half-life and the decay of potassium argon has always been constant. It has not been influenced by any outside sources. It's interesting that even the geologists themselves know the process, the metamorphic processes of leaching and the solidification when the rock forms, that environmental factors can influence that immediately. But yet they subscribe to this uniformitarian doctrine, and that's the glue to the whole evolutionary framework, and that is the glue to the old age theory, or I should say the old age model. That's the assumption. The rubidium strontium method, because scientists have found their heir, you want to call them, they could get what they'd say, the butthead award, if you will. They figured that out in the 70s. Yeah, this doesn't look too good. I guess we know that there's other processes that can affect it. We know that the rates of decay have not been constant. So they said, I got an idea, this rubidium strontium method. And they used what they would call the isochron method. Oh, this is, now we have it accurate. Now we know exactly how much of the parent element was there, how much of the daughter element was there. We know the decay rates. But you know what? It has also failed. Like many secular scientists themselves, has also come up with many publications within the past decade to show the error in that teaching as far as the rubidium strontium method as being accurate. So now secular scientists have abandoned that and now are trying to find some other geophysical process, some geochronometer, to say, hey, we've got it now. The Earth is billions of years old. And again, they have to. That's their gospel. That's their life. I mean, if something comes across where it's not millions or billions of years old, that's a blow to them. That's a blow to their whole life study. To give a couple quotes regarding the radiometric dating, Frederick B. Juman, an evolutionary scientist, sums it up. The age of our globe is presently thought to be some 4.5 billion years based on radio decay rates of uranium and thorium. Such confirmation may be short-lived, as nature has not been discovered so easily. There has been in recent years the horrible realization that radio decay rates are not as constant as previously thought, nor are they immune to environmental influences. And this could mean that the atomic clocks are reset during some global disasters, and that maybe, this is a secular, this is an evolutionist, maybe, he talks about the Mesozoic age may not have been 65 million years ago, but maybe in the age and memory of modern man. In other words, he says these catastrophes and even that of dinosaurs may not be millions of years ago. Maybe it's within the age of modern man. What he means by modern man is what we have historically preserved. All the historical records only go back 4,000 or 5,000 years, the Egyptian, Sumerian, all various forms of nations, and even China, only go back a few thousand years. Never has anyone say, I found something that's 20,000, 30,000 years old. Only a few thousand years old. Also, it's interesting that it is those dates. Remember, your children, have been indoctrinated with this idea of billions of years because of this radiometric dating system. There are a few other geochronometers that may indicate an old Earth, but they're not accurate, and that's not their glue. That's not their prized possession like radiometric dating is. And it's only certain dates that are published, and there's much scandals, oppression of information. There's many things going on in the secular scientific community. And to give you an example, Dr. Richard Mauger, a geologist, again an evolutionist, states, in general, dates in the correct ballpark are assumed to be correct and are published, but those in disagreement with their data are seldom published, nor are the discrepancies fully explained. In other words, they go find a piece of rock and, oh, it's only a million years old. Well, that doesn't fit 4.5 billion years old. We don't publish that. And all the various geochronometers that have been hidden from America in the past 75, 80 years to show a young Earth are not taught in schools. They're not taught. They're not even published in scientific publications because it's not science, they say. It doesn't fit our uniformitarian evolution thinking. And, of course, many secular scientists who are true to science understand that, know that, and to them it's a big enigma. So the very few geochronometers, and there are only a very few that would give evidence to fit or would lead one to believe an old Earth model. What about a young Earth model? Are there any evidence that we can observe today in the 20th century that would fit the predictions of a young Earth model? And I believe there are many. One of them in particular is the Earth's magnetic field. Much work has been done in the past 20 years, 30 years, especially by a gentleman by the name of a physicist, Thomas Barnes. And Dr. Thomas Barnes has done an extensive work, a phenomenal work, on the idea of the origins of the Earth's magnetic field. And without getting real technical into this, he has shown that and by measurements that have been going on for over 150 years, that the Earth's magnetic field is decaying at a half rate of 1,400 years. In other words, 7,000 years ago, the Earth's magnetic field was 32 times stronger. During the time of Christ, when Christ was walking here on Earth, the Earth's magnetic field was more than double than what it is today. And by extrapolation, he shows that an upper limit of the Earth's magnetic field can be no older than the Earth itself can be no older than 10,000 years, because the magnetic field caused within the core of the Earth by rapid moving electrons that produce a magnetic field much like a dipole magnet, north pole, south pole, many of you can remember in your physics class, would dissolve all the elements of the Earth. So if the Earth was more than 10,000 years old, the force would have been so strong, the Earth would have become a magnetic star. Many secular scientists have tried to put forth a great amount of work trying to refute Dr. Barnes's work, and they have not been successful. The so-called dynamo process, paleomagnetic process, have all been refuted by Dr. Barnes and several other physicists, both secular, evolutionary, and creationist. As a matter of fact, Dr. Russell Humphrey, a creationist, also well-respected among the evolutionary world, has shown and corroborated Dr. Thomas's Barn work and did an extensive study, and I don't have time to go into it, and I'm not going to go into the technicalities of all this. But there are many other geochronometers, geophysical processes that we can observe today. We can take the carbon-14 buildup within the upper atmosphere by a very complex process. Nitrogen is bombarded with cosmic rays, which therefore is turned into carbon-14, and carbon-14 decays at a half-life of 5,730 years. And again, I will be passing out in a few minutes. You can probably go ahead and start passing out some more information on this. You can read at your leisure that since we observe today a buildup of carbon-14 that is 1.5 times more than carbon-12, giving evidence that the Earth cannot be more than 30,000 years, because it takes about 30,000 years for all the carbon-14 to decay back to nitrogen. And by extrapolation, we are able to estimate, again, that the age of the Earth is only about 10,000 years old based on the large buildup of carbon-14. There's not an equilibrium state between carbon-14 and carbon-12, nor is there a decrease in carbon-14 compared to carbon-12. I can also talk about the alpha decay rate, the flux of helium into the Earth's atmosphere. by various rocks that are formed in the strata and the core within the Earth. As uranium and thorium decay, they release alpha and gamma rays in the form of helium. And that was one of the questions that secular scientists asked in the 50s and 60s. Where's the helium? If the Earth is millions of years old, billions of years old, where is all this radiogenic helium? And all various theories have been put forth to try to, you know, trying to scratch your head, figuring out where did this helium go. And by the way, those who think that helium can, because it is very less, the mass of that, it's very light, can escape into the upper atmosphere out to outer space, it's not as easy as what you'd think. It can escape, and calculations have been done by a physicist, Dr. Larry Verdeman, who's shown that the amount of helium that escapes into the outer space is very minimal. And today we should see, with this mindset that the Earth is millions of years old, we should have a substantial amount of helium, but we do not. I could also talk about the discoveries, and this is one of the most phenomenal discoveries in the 20th century, by a gentleman by the name of Dr. Robert Gentry. Now, I don't know if any of you have heard of Dr. Robert Gentry. He's a geophysicist. He also was a witness for the state of Arkansas in 1982 when they had the so-called Fair Creation Evolution Act. He was, of course, a creationist, and I won't get into that subject at this time. But it's interesting that Dr. Robert Gentry did a major study into what known as polonium halos. And polonium halos is what I'll get into details here. I don't want to bore anyone to use. But to have polonium halos in rocks, the half-life of polonium halos is 3.5 minutes. So to have these halos preserved in rocks, and he analyzed these granite rocks, Precambrian rocks, which are the basement rocks of the Earth, if you will. To have these preserved, that means they would have had to solidify, crystallize within 3 minutes or less for them to be preserved. Therefore, that points to an instant creation of dry land, which I think that depicts in the third day of Genesis, where the waters receded and instantly solidified the land, and land became visible. He also did major work in geology, and that in high pressure fluid study with the idea of oil. He showed that the oil reservoirs must be of recent origin because of the impossibility of maintaining high fluid pressures under trap formations. So in other words, oil, not only can oil form rapidly, crude oil and what have you, it has to form rapidly. It cannot be millions of years old to sustain the amount of pressure in the strata beneath the Earth. And that's a known in geology too, and that's why it's another enigma, and they're just kind of scratching their head and, well, what's going on here? And all these things are coming up now with the move of creation science. I can also talk about that of Mount St. Helens and the catastrophe that took place, but I don't want to get into all that right now. If you would turn on the third page, appendix 6. This was taken out of Biblical Basis for Modern Science by Dr. Henry Morris. And what this shows is 68 geochronometers, 68 geophysical processes we can observe today. And he gives the references for these, some of them which I had briefly mentioned. And if you look, many of them show a young Earth. None of them go into the billions of years as commonly taught by evolutionists. Many of them show an Earth younger than 100,000 years old, and even see some of the processes we observe today are too small to measure, show the Earth only being 100 years old, which of course is impossible. But what this goes to show is that applying a uniformitarian assumption, because if any of you understood exactly what I did in explaining the Earth's magnetic field and that of carbon-14 surplus, I applied what secular scientists apply today, the assumption that processes have not changed. The assumption that the Earth's magnetic field was decaying at a half-life of 1,400 years has always been constant. I just applied their own glue and showed that, hey, I'm coming up with a young Earth. As a matter of fact, using that reasoning, using this uniformitarian assumption, it'll be evident here, and there are literally thousands of geophysical processes you can observe today that show a young Earth, younger even than hundreds of thousands of years. So it's interesting that how you can even play their own game and come up fitting the young earth model. What we have talked about so far, we could have went in more detail. What I have presented is nothing more than circumstantial evidence. Now, how many people have tried and convicted on circumstantial evidence? Not too many. Therefore, I'm not asking you to be very incredulous and believe that the earth is young based on circumstantial evidence. But I want to stress again that there are more geophysical processes we can observe today. There is more scientific, quote, evidence to support a young earth than there is an old earth. And it is only those few that support an old earth that receive all the publicity and get the publication. And I have other quotes too where many secular scientists even admit that fact. So that I want everyone aware that this is the crux, the radiometric dating. That's where all this millions and billions of years comes in. It doesn't come in from the Bible. You know, secular scientists don't use this. Okay? To them, that's not even history to them, and not even remotely is history. So we need to keep that in mind. So what are we to do? How are we to go about showing a young Earth? Well, Kurt Gödel's theorem states that within a model, in order for one to falsify or to verify the validity of a particular model, assumption, one must go outside that system. Now, he applied that to mathematics, and I don't want to belabor that issue. But the same is true for anything. The idea of the young Earth, old Earth model, we must go outside the system of beliefs to verify or falsify the young Earth, old Earth model. And we can't do that because, as even Steve conceded, God the Father and Jesus Christ were there at creation. They, in the absolute sense, they were witnessing creation. They initiated the creation. And also, I believe that God has demonstrated and revealed to us through his word that the earth is young, which I will show in a few minutes. Now let's read in Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the natural, and let me say very perspicuous, interpretation of Genesis 1, and for that matter, Genesis 1 through 11, is that God created the heavens and the earth in 6 literal days only a few thousand years ago. Now, if you were on a desert island, let's throw all this secular science stuff out. You're on a desert island, the Bible flows up, you pop open Genesis, you read Genesis 1 through 11. How are you going to understand that? You're going to say the earth is only a few thousand years old based on the pre-flood genealogies of Genesis, Genesis 5 and the post-flood genealogies of Genesis 11. Even if you are to allow gaps, which I do allow gaps in them genealogies, you cannot allow gaps going into millions or billions of years, not even hundreds of thousands of years for that matter. Now, if you're one that advocates or subscribes to Archbishop James Usher chronology of the earth, 4004 BC being relatively about 6,000 years old, that's okay. That's fine. I'm not arguing against that. I don't totally agree with that, because I do believe the chronologies, the genealogies there in Genesis 5 and Genesis 11, and even that in the gospel narratives, reveal gaps. But these gaps, again, I'm stressing, cannot, even your liberal scholars will say these gaps are not hundreds of thousands of years old. That's one thing I want to emphasize. As Steve had hit on, the gap theory, I would classify it as the rune and reconstruction theory. I'm well aware of it, at once being an advocate of that theory. Also, I was what is known as the day-age theory. And I don't normally go a lot into this. I usually say this for part two. But let me briefly just mention a few remarks regarding, let's take the day-age theory. In the 1800s, particularly the early 1800s, when catastrophism began to phase out, that is, that the earth, there was a catastrophe like the Noachian deluge and so on and so forth, geologists began to believe in long ages. And many Christians tried to accommodate that by various theories and doctrines. One of the first ones was the day-age theory. They would take the word, Hebrew word, yom, and sorry, Charles, if I mispronounced that. They would take that, and of course, by itself, linguistically, it can mean long ages. But we know as students of the Bible, you have to always do a contextual study to decipher, to understand exactly what the writer's intended purpose was. And Genesis leaves no doubt in any person's mind that the word day, yom, is to be taken as our 24-hour literal days. As a matter of fact, Professor James Barr, a liberal Old Testament classic scholar, and I will quote him as he writes a personal letter to David Watson dated April 23, 1984. So far as I know, there is no professor of Hebrew or Old Testament at any world class university who does not believe that the writer or writers of Genesis 1 through 11 intended to convey to their readers the idea that creation took place in a series of 6 days, which were the same days as the 24-hour days we experience now. In other words, what he's simply saying is that no Hebrew scholar or that he knows of, which I'm sure he knows many, would say that no, the writer's intention was not for you to understand it as literal, because they understand that that's what it was. They knew that the writer's intention, whether they believe it was Moses or various other authors, they simply say that was what they wanted to convey to the readers, that God created in literal 6 24-hour days. And they even understand that linguistically, and there's much linguistic evidence for that. And I'm not going to belabor the day-age theory, because that has phased out. That's no longer prevalent among many Christians and even scholars for that matter. What about the ruin and reconstruction theory, the gap theory? I wish I had time to really talk about this, but there is no, and I could state this rather dogmatically, from all the resources I've consulted, liberal, conservative, moderate, there is no linguistical, contextual, theological evidence to show of a gap theory. It's all assumptions and presuppositions. As a matter of fact, if I may, in the new Jewish translation in Genesis, the first chapter, they translate it in Genesis 1:1, when God began to create heaven and earth, in verse 2, the earth being unformed and void with darkness over the face of the earth, and it's a continuization. There is no gap of millions or billions of years, and I could argue the word sometimes translated was or became really is irrelevant, because most Hebrew scholars, almost all Hebrew scholars, understand that the word has to mean it was. That's the way the earth was. That's the way the author is talking. As a matter of fact, almost all Hebrew scholars acknowledge that Genesis verse 1 is the subject and verb clause, with verse 2 containing 3 circumstantial clauses. Or to put it in layman's term, Genesis 1:1 sets the context, and it telescopes, like a telescope, in Genesis 1:2. There is no gap there. Genesis 1:1 sets the context, then he focuses in on the earth. In other words, God created the heavens and the earth was the introductory statement. Then he focuses in on earth. At the beginning, remember, there's only one beginning with God. There's not several beginnings. God's very dogmatic on that point. In the beginning, not in the beginning millions of years ago, not in another beginning, but only one beginning and only one end. But here in Genesis, it's in the beginning, he created the heavens and the earth. And at that time, in the beginning, that's how we are to understand a very, very natural interpretation of that. The earth was without form and not inhabited. Okay, and it was, I could get into the idea of it being it was a watery matrix. And on the third day, he separated the waters and the land appeared. But again, the point of all this, and I could quote the New Bible Dictionary, I've got several quotes here, various, that just say the gap theory is just erroneous. It just, there is no way a Hebrew scholar, if one claims to be a Hebrew scholar, they can ever accept the gap theory. There is no linguistic evidence. There is no contextual evidence. There is no theological evidence. I know it's a very bold statement, but I feel confident in making that. Now, one of the things we can go on, I suppose we can go on more and talk about Genesis, the days, how they're situated and all that. And again, that's usually, I leave that for another another subject. And I could talk about the studies of Edward Young, another Hebrew scholar who has yet to this day to be refuted, shows that linguistically Genesis 1 is to be interpreted as naturally. A few thousand years ago, God created the heavens and the earth and exactly lays it out in a chronological sequence in the first couple chapters of Genesis. Where did all this belief come from? Now, one thing, Genesis has been reinterpreted only within the past 200 years. Has only been reinterpreted within the past 200 years. Prior to that time, whether we talk about the apostolic age and even into the Judaic faith itself, they have always understood Genesis as history. Okay, they understood the historicity of Genesis. To them, the earth was always relatively young, a few thousand years old. They never thought in terms of long ages. It was impossible to them. Even through the Reformation, that was the mindset of all Christians. What happened? What changed in the 1800s? It was this whole idea of uniformitarianism, this evolutionary thinking, this secular creationism, if you will, that began to creep in and infiltrate many of the Christian churches. And they wanted to fit the geological ages, and that's the whole point. They want to fit the so-called geological column that everything has been going on, has been happening for ages and ages and ages, and within these ages we have various forms of life. And that's how they try to accommodate and how they compromise the Bible with secular evolution. Now, I might add that many of us in this room are Sabbatarians. We observe the seventh day. We worship our Creator on the seventh day because He ordained it that way. Sabbath day has a special impact on creation, memorializes creation. They're so much interrelated. And we of all people should remain consistent with our hermeneutics, with our interpretation of Scripture. Now, if we turn to the fourth commandment, if you will, in Exodus, the 20th chapter. In verse 8, he talks about, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. In verse 9, a very sobering scripture. Verse 11, for in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and he rested on the seventh day. His own words right there is that he made the heavens and the earth and all that's in them. That includes dinosaurs, that includes the angels, that includes man, plants, the galaxies that you see out there, everything in 6 literal days. Now, if you ever wondered why it took God so long to create, there's your answer right there. Because he could have just spoke and everything could have just happened just instantaneously. Men, dinosaurs, everything, all in one day or all in 1 second. But you see, Exodus 20, Exodus 31, and various other scriptures alludes to the fact that he patterned after for man, patterned the creation week for man. That of idea of worshiping, that idea of honoring him. And there's many other implications I wish I had time to get into. But the whole point of it is that if you were an Israelite back then, when Moses or when God uttered and spoke that commandment, they didn't question it. Yes, you created everything in 6 literal days, and now I'm going to memorialize this creation by observing your Sabbath. Can you imagine if God was lying to them, that he didn't create everything in 6 literal days, that there was another creation, that there was a recreation, that what the Bible never speaks of? You know, the point of it is that Israelites until many Christians all the way up until through the Reformation always thought that God created something in the whole earth and universe in 6 literal days. In Genesis 1:31, he says that everything was good. Everything he saw was good. Can you imagine Adam standing there on the 6th day of creation as he named all the animals? Looks up at this omnipotent being and God says, everything's good. And here's Adam trampling on billions, literally billions of dead things. Well, that's exactly what Gappists and various theistic evolutions believe. God pronounced everything good, but here's Adam walking on a graveyard of dead things, and what does the fossil record speak of? It speaks of decay, destruction, disease, you name it. Catastrophe? To me, it just doesn't make sense logically. Also, Adam was to have dominion over everything. Well, Evidently, Adam didn't have dominion over the dinosaurs, if the dinosaurs lived millions and billions of years old. He didn't have dominion over a pre-Adamic race that many suppose occurred before Adam was created. It just doesn't make sense. In Psalms, the 8th chapter, he reveals that all of creation was for man, and the man was to have dominion over all creation. Also in Hebrews, the 1st chapter, I believe, he talks about the ministry of angels. Angels were created to minister to man. Now, can you imagine? Think about this. He creates angels and Satan literally billions and eons, ages ago, to minister to man. That wouldn't come along on a scene for billions and millions of years. It doesn't make sense. Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 has the ordering, it has the very perspicuous understanding that all that was for man, all that was laid out in 6 days for man. It didn't take billions and millions of years. Also, what I like to challenge many people on, I will throw all scientific evidence out, I will throw all scriptures out except for two. If you can explain to me Romans 5:12 and 1 Corinthians 15:21, that which speaks of death and destruction coming in by man, as a result of Adam's sin, not Satan's sin, Adam's sin, death and destruction came in. Now, that's very important if you really, I know Dr. Philip Arnold talked about decay and bondage and all that stuff, because that is very important when you understand in the context of creation. As a matter of fact, if you turn with me to Romans 8:20, we read here, "For the creation was subject..." Remember, the creation, only one creation here. Paul never talks about, well, he does talk about two creations, the old creation versus the new creation, but never two old creations, never in Pauline theology. "For the creation was subject to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subject, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated." There's that key word. I know Dr. Philip Arnold was talking about that. "Liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God." We have here Paul, a theologian and scientist, because Calvin wasn't even around with the second law of thermodynamics that speaks of entropy, interning, that of decay. Paul simply right here explains why we see the second law of thermodynamics active today, why we see bondage and decay today, why we see processes, why we see energy becoming more and more useless as ages go on, all because of man, all because of what man did back there in the Garden of Eden only a few thousand years ago. Paul's very dogmatic on that point, and he shows a relationship between creation, between man, and between redemption. The processes of decay will only be reversed when man is redeemed, that is, fully redeemed, when they come into the glorious presence of the omnipotent Creator. Then there'll be the new heavens and new earth. All processes we see today will no longer exist as we know them. Can you imagine having 100% efficiency output on a machinery? Can you imagine having no decay at all? No corruption? No bondage? And that's exactly what Paul goes back to creation to show that it's all because of Adam. Well, it's not because of angels. Angels were secondary. Angels had their role. They were only to minister to man. You're going to ask me real quickly how I think Satan rebelled? I think it's very logical. Satan seen there, I think he was created on the first day. I think Psalms 104 alludes to that. I wish I had time to go into that. But Satan, as he was standing there, seen God creating all this, he seen Adam being created, and he says, he's made in your image, and he's going to have dominion over everything? I could just see that pride and that rebellion in him. Instantly, he sinned. It doesn't take billions of years for someone to sin. I have not known anyone where it takes 5 or 10 years for someone to sin. It happens instantly. And same with an angelic being, they can rebel instantly. But again, the whole idea of creation was for man, not angels. All for man. Everything depended on man. His choice there, yours and my choice, there in the Garden of Eden, because we were there in a federal head sense, in the corporate sense, it depended on man. Man blew it then. And of course, Paul contrasts the old Adam, which is the old age, and the new creation, the new Adam, which of course is Christ. We could go on and talk about the idea of, well, he's speaking of a recreation. Many Gappists will say, well, Paul's speaking of a recreation, this age now. Well, the Bible has no indication of a recreation. As a matter of fact, Jesus' own words in Matthew 19, he says, at the beginning, the Creator made them male and female. What he just did there, Jesus understands the historicity of Genesis, accepts it, doesn't deny it. He accepts it, and he says, in the beginning, Adam and Eve, male and female, he created them near the beginning. That was the beginning. He associates them very close to the beginning of time. Not a beginning, but the beginning. We need to keep that in mind. There's only one beginning, okay? There's only one beginning. As a matter of fact, we're finite beings, so we always think of time. God doesn't have to think of time. Before the beginning, there was no time. If someone asked you, where was God before that, that's a ridiculous question because there was no time. You can't ask a question. God was not, we like to tie, put God into time. God doesn't have to go into time. He never was into time. I could go on and talk about 2 Peter when he alludes to the catastrophe, the world that perished. He alludes to Genesis 1, chapter 2, taking that historically as only one creation, only understanding there to be one creation. As a matter of fact, if what male and female would Jesus be talking about if he was not referring to only one creation? What would be the significance of the new heavens and new earth soon to come if there were a couple of times when there were new heavens and new earth? And for that matter, what are we to think of Pauline theology when he often contrasts the old creation with the new creation? What old creation is he talking about? Is he talking about the old creation of angelic beings and dinosaurs running around? It's very inconsistent. There was no, the only old creation is what we observe today, the historical evidence there preserved in Genesis, only relatively perhaps 10,000 years old. Now, if this is all hard, I know I'm getting a little short on time here, but if this is hard for us to swallow, this is hard to grasp, let me just mention a few things. When he creates, when God creates, he creates elements, material, man, plants, with what some like to call apparent age. I prefer not to use the word apparent age. I like to use the word fully functional. He created Adam with probably an apparent age of 30 years old. In other words, he was fully functional, mature, male, adult. He created the first plants, the first animals, with seed in them, fully mature. Why could not he have created the earth and the universes and the galaxies fully functional? Obviously, I think Genesis shows that he did create it fully functional. And that's how God works. Is a young earth vital for Christians? In my opinion, I think it is. But one thing, a young earth is more scientific and more consistent and more fair to scriptures, accepting the historicity of Genesis, than interpreting an old earth. But the most important thing, and if you get anything out of this today, I always want to try to put this in your mind, write it down, is that a young earth gives God his glory due. I'll repeat that. A young earth gives God his glory due. And let me explain what I mean by that real quickly. In the Gospel of John, the second chapter, verse 11, he talks about the first miracle of that of turning water into wine. And he showed that these miracles reveal God's glory, reveal the glory of the Son. Now, when we do a study on miracles, if any of us have done a study in miracles, whether Old or New Testament, something is very different about these miracles, in that many of them, most of them, do not follow natural processes. There's instantaneously fully functional creation, if you will, involved in these miracles.